the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Welcome to week 4 of our series exploring the book of Micah. So far, we've learnt that Micah probably began speaking in the early 700s BC, during a time when Assyria was flexing its power by invading its neighbours. We've learnt that Micah travelled from the countryside to the city of Jerusalem to speak a series of messages, over time, to Israel's leaders. And also that in the book of Micah, his speeches have been grouped together into three waves which build on each other, giving more information and greater detail about the circumstances the people of God were experiencing. We've seen how each wave combines pronouncements of judgment against the people's behaviour and pronouncements of hope that the current suffering will one day end, to be replaced with peace and prosperity. Well, last week, Nick claimed he was surfing along the second wave as we all look together at chapter 4, a wave that talks about the hope of peace. Although I was somewhat distracted a little imagining whether Nick is actually a competent surfer or not, I've never saw him as the sporty type, I certainly would encourage any of you who did not hear last week to find week 3 on our podcast or website, since chapter 4 plays a central role in Micah's overall message to the people of God. Tonight we arrive in chapter 5, which ends the second wave of Micah's speeches. And to continue our surfing analogy, you'll have to decide whether I rip the wave or wipe out tonight in what I say. So let's drop in to chapter 5. It opens with a very unflattering view of the present king of Israel and the situation the city of Jerusalem finds itself in. The Hebrew is actually very difficult to translate. The NIV's attempt to translate it reads, as we've already heard, "Marshal your troops now, city of troops, for a siege is laid against us. They will strike Israel's ruler on the cheek with a rod." What Micah is telling his audience is that Israel is humiliated before the nations as invaders surround Jerusalem, and that Israel's king is powerless to prevent Jerusalem, the home of God's temple, falling to their enemies. Those trusted with leading the people of God in their mission, their vocation to be a light to the nations, have failed. When other nations looked to Israel, what did they see? A failed state. A conquered country, a powerless, worthless, broken society dominated by others. A people whose God was powerless. A God not worth wasting any time worshipping. Surely it'd be better to follow another God, perhaps a God of the victors, those who've been successful. But Micah tells God's people that all is not lost. Verses 2 to 9 in chapter 5 declare that their present defeat will be overcome with the arrival of a new king. So why will the new king succeed where currently there is only failure? The first point Micah makes concerns where this new king will come from. Well, where would you naturally look for a king? Most, I'm sure, like me, would assume the capital city, the centre of power. Amongst the political elite, amongst those who are financially successful, those who have connections and contacts. Indeed, in the New Testament, we can read about when the Magi, the wise men, came looking for God's anointed one. Where did they look? Matthew helpfully tells us in chapter 2, verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." They naturally assumed a king would be found in a capital city. So let me read Micah 5 verse 2 again to you. "But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times." Now, Micah's central criticism of Israel, which we explored in week 2, was that the current leaders were corrupt. They no longer worshipped God, but worshipped wealth and power instead. In response, Micah tells the people that God is going to raise up a new king, one who is not tarnished with the corruption of the state, one who will come from the margins, from outside the inner circle, not a member of the old boys' network, not someone who has been groomed and prepared for leadership by those already in power. The new king is not coming from Jerusalem. Interestingly, Nick told us in week one of our Micah series that Micah himself was a country yokel, an outsider, someone from the margins. And as you read the story of the people of God in the Old Testament, I wonder if you've noticed that many of the people God raised up to serve him came from the margins, came from humble origins. God seems to deliberately choose people outside of the natural seats of power to serve him. Now the phrase, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times, found in chapter 5 verse 2, goes further to suggest this new king, unlike the present leaders, will return to the faithfulness of the past. Those hearing the phrase would immediately think of King David, God's champion of the past. Micah promises that the coming king will not be another corrupt failure, but will have the character of King David. There will be a new Davidic king. Micah builds on this theme in verse 4 by telling the people that the new king will faithfully shepherd the people of God. As it says, he will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they will live securely, for then his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth. Micah is now making a point about the qualities and character of this new king. Shepherding is also mentioned in chapter 2 and chapter 7. It's an important metaphor for leadership used throughout the Old Testament. But why? Because a shepherd's role is to look after sheep, to help them grow strong and healthy, to provide the best conditions for them to prosper. Now last week, Alison and I were channel surfing and we came across our Yorkshire farm on Channel 5. I'm not sure if any of you have seen it. It's one of those fly on the wall documentaries, and this one is actually following the lives of a family of sheep farmers, of shepherds in the Yorkshire Dales. One of the things we saw time and again during the show was how the sheep managed to get themselves into trouble. There was a really funny scene with both parents chasing sheep through the downstairs rooms of their house while their kids sat on the sofa watching the TV. Someone had left the back door open and some of the sheep couldn't resist the opportunity. And in another episode, the four-year-old daughter can be seen chasing sheep out of the barn and can be heard afterwards telling the rest of the family off for leaving the yard gate open. Already at the age of four, she knows something about the nature of sheep. Sheep not only need protecting from external dangers, the weather and predators, but they also sometimes need protecting from themselves. Sheep need shepherds, since sheep are very creative at finding ways to get into trouble. The role of the shepherd is to prioritise the well-being of the sheep. If the sheep grow weak and ill, if they're underweight, damaged or wander off, then the shepherd has failed. And in the same way, kings are meant to look after their people and help them to prosper. If you read the books of the Old Testament prophets, you'll constantly read of the failure of Israel's leaders at shepherding the people of God. For example, let me read from Ezekiel 34. The word of the Lord came to me, "Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. Prophesy and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Woe to you, shepherds of Israel, who only take of yourselves. Should not shepherds take care of the flock? You eat the curds, clothe yourselves with the wool, and slaughter the choice animals, but you do not take care of the flock. You have not strengthened the weak, or healed the sick, or bound up the injured. You have not brought back the strays, or searched for the lost. You have ruled them harshly and brutally." Well, in chapter 5, Micah promises that a new shepherd is coming, a true shepherd, one like the shepherd king of old, King David. And this true shepherd will bring peace, shalom, to Israel. The people of God will no longer be the food for the wild beasts surrounding them. Well, I wonder if you've ever played that game. If you were a dot dot dot, what would you be? If you were an animal, what would you be? Would you ever consider yourself to be a sheep? Is a sheep a positive image to identify yourself by? Do you believe you need others to protect you, not only from outsiders, but also to protect you from your own choices? I believe the shepherding metaphor found regularly in the Bible, and particularly here in Micah, challenges the way that society has brought us up to celebrate freedom and independence, to almost idolise individualism. A society which perhaps less so today, but definitely in the past, taught that relying on others or following others rather than doing it yourself was a weakness. Micah as a book certainly challenges me to think about where do I look to get my values, my sense of self and purpose in life. If you're open to admitting that there is at least a bit of a sheep in everyone, then how do you decide which shepherd to follow? Micah tells the people of God they can trust this new king because they will shepherd in the strength of the Lord. This king will be a faithful to God. Now chapter 5 not only tells the people that a new shepherd king will come, one who will guide the people, who will reign justly, who will treat the people equally, who will look after everyone's interests and not just their own. Micah goes on to tell the people when the king will arrive. Not now, when Jerusalem is surrounded by enemies, but in the future. Yes, the people can have confidence that one day he will come. And his coming will be transformative. Yes, when he comes, the world will be forever changed as he brings shalom. But, and it's a big but, he is coming in the future. As it says in verse 3, therefore Israel will be abandoned until the time when she who is in labour bears a son, and the rest of his brothers return to join the Israelites. So why the delay? Why is the God of love not coming to rescue his people as the nations gather to lay siege to Jerusalem? Micah is clear that the injustices that the leaders of Israel have committed, those lifestyle choices that they taught the people of God to follow, the idolatry I mentioned in week 2, sin with a capital S, which leads to evil behaviour, sin with a small s, must be dealt with first. This is what verses 10 to 15 explain. In that day, declares the Lord, I will destroy your horses from among you and demolish your chariots. I will destroy the cities of your land and tear down all your strongholds. I will destroy your witchcraft and you will no longer cast spells. I will destroy your idols and your sacred stones from among you. You will no longer bow down to the work of your hands. I will uproot from among you your Asherah poles. When I demolish your cities, I will take vengeance in anger and wrath on the nations that have not obeyed me. God's people, the very people who are meant to be a light to the world, have followed their leaders and wandered off into the darkness of the other nations. The people have turned their backs on God and looked to their own strength, military force and fortifications for their security. The people have turned their backs on God and chosen to worship other powers and gods. Sorcery, Asherah poles and Baal stones are all mentioned. Therefore, destruction and exile are coming first as judgment from God. Yes, a new king is coming. Yes, a shepherd king is coming, a Davidic king. But they will be in the future, following God's judgment. Now, like other parts of the Bible, Micah talks a lot about judgment and punishment. It's found in all three waves of his message. So I want to digress a little now from our theme of kingship to touch briefly on verse 15, which some may find slightly disturbing. Let me read it to you again. I will take vengeance in anger and wrath on the nations that have not obeyed me. Well, how can a loving God take vengeance in anger and wrath? Now, when the people sinned, when they turned away from God during Old Testament times, we need to understand how God responded to their behaviour. For a start, God often withdrew from intimate relationship with his people. We see this in their unanswered prayers, in the silence the people found themselves in. Micah himself mentions this in chapter 3, verse 4. Then they will cry out to the Lord, but he will not answer them. At that time, he will hide his face from them because of the evil they have done. God sometimes lets the natural consequences of their actions work themselves out. In a sense, punishment is self-inflicted. But God also at times proactively brought punishment on his people for all the injustice they committed. As we have already heard in earlier chapters and will hear next week, God calls on his people to create a society that is just, where justice is seen and done. Well, I wonder, what's your definition of justice? What should a just society look like? My favourite definition of justice comes from Joseph Fletcher when he said, "Love and justice are the same, for justice is love distributed, nothing else." So if justice is love in action, then a just society is when everyone loves their neighbours as they love themselves. Injustice occurs when people stop loving, when they act selfishly, when they prioritise themselves over others, when those born with privilege idolise their power and status rather than worshipping God. This has been Micah's complaint, as I've said previously, throughout chapters 1 to 3. We see this lack of love clearly in the complaints of the Me Too movement, when women are treated as objects to own and use instead of treated as equals. We have recently heard so much personal testimony from the Black Lives Matter movement about the injustices they have suffered through discrimination and marginalisation. If justice is love in action, then God's wrath is best understood as God's overwhelming love for the victims of injustice, which results in his anger at those who deliberately withhold their love from their neighbours. God's wrath tells the victims of injustice that they matter. God's wrath tells the perpetrator that they will be held accountable for the injustice they committed. So God's wrath is also God's love in action. Is that the way you understand his wrath? Lastly, as Nick said in week one, God's punishment is never about simply getting even. When we explore the flow of salvation history, as we move from Genesis, from creation, through the Old Testament and into the New, towards Revelation and recreation, we discover that God's punishment takes on a more and more restorative role. Now I'm sure you noticed the word vengeance in verse 15 that I read out earlier. The bit we all probably miss in many of our English Bibles is that the Hebrew word translated as vengeance is actually a legal term. We often associate vengeance with retaliation, revenge, and excessive punishment, but this is to misunderstand its real Hebrew meaning. The Hebrew word translated vengeance refers to when a king, or a judge, or in this case God, determines the innocence or guilt of the accused. It is the passing of a suitable punishment if the accused is found guilty. Now, an important role of punishment in the Bible is to reform people, to change the guilty person's behaviour and attitude, to help them learn from their past, to transform them, to be moved from loving themselves to be loving their neighbours. I wonder if you agree with the explanations of justice, wrath and punishment I have sketched out tonight. Are they more in keeping with ancient Jewish thought and culture? Now, many Eastern Orthodox Christians have historically critiqued the Western Church for adopting a more Roman understanding of justice than Jewish. And even evangelicals such as Tom Wright have questioned whether the Church, at times, has made the Christian God to be more like Baal or Asherah or Molech, the gods of the ancient Near East at the time of Micah, rather than the God revealed through the Gospels, through the life, death and resurrection of Jesus. With my explanations of justice, wrath and punishment, perhaps verse 15 is not as shocking as you may have first thought. Why not watch the Bible Project video on justice this week to hear their explanation of biblical justice, to see if you agree with them? If you want to chat more on these themes, perhaps to push back against my understanding of justice, etc., or you want to explore the topics more, then I'm happy to carry on a conversation over a virtual or socially distanced coffee. Now, the reason I don't have time to unpack these themes more now is that I have a particular rule whenever I'm studying a Bible passage, and particularly an Old Testament passage. I must always see how it fits into God's bigger picture. The story of God and his creation, starting in Genesis 1 and ending in Revelation 22, from creation to recreation. Old Testament texts must be understood in the light of the New Testament. Well, having looked at the promise of a new king, a future king, we should end today by talking about the arrival of the king. In Jesus, the long-awaited king has arrived. When Jesus was born, first century Jews were still awaiting their future king, the anointed one, their Messiah. But in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, we see the work of God's promised king. The Messiah, the long-awaited king, has arrived. But it's a very different rule to what many expected. Jesus is revealed in the New Testament as the true shepherd king, a king who loved the marginalized, loved those who had been left out or left behind by the powerful. We see this time and time again in the time he spent with sinners, women, tax collectors, the ill, etc. In Jesus, we see a king who challenges, disrupts, and dismantles power structures. We see this in the way he challenged the religious rulers, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, when he disrupted the running of the temple, when he talked and responded to the questions Pontius Pilate gave him. In Jesus, we see a king who reveals the character of God. We see God's love for his creation in Jesus' willingness to be the good shepherd who laid down his life for his sheep. But Jesus was more than simply a human king, because he bore our sin and through his death and resurrection defeated sin, death, and the devil. Jesus was a king who came at the right time, to the right place, to make things right again, to establish God's just kingdom on earth as in heaven. We traditionally celebrate communion weekly at Belmont because we know that through the coming of King Jesus, broken and dysfunctional relationships with God, each other, creation, and even ourselves can be mended. We can become whole again. Just as Jesus came into the world to liberate us from sin, death, and the devil, he sends his people out into the world to share his story of reconciliation and redemption, and to live lives which bring justice to others. So may I encourage you this week to read through some gospel passages, to find more examples which reminds us of how Jesus spoke truth to powers, how he embraced the marginalized, how he gave up his life as a shepherd king for his sheep. Why not take the time this week to remind yourself what justice, what love in action looked like in the life of Jesus and the early church? And to think about how you too can join in bringing God's justice to God's creation in Exeter, the UK and beyond. Let me end tonight with a prayer for all of us, taken from Hebrews 13. Now may the God of peace, who through the blood of the eternal covenant brought back from the dead our Lord Jesus, that great shepherd of the sheep, equip each of us with everything good for doing God's will. And may he work in us, by the power of the Spirit, that which is pleasing to him. Through Jesus Christ, to whom be glory for ever and ever. Amen.